Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Our speaker is being recorded tonight with his permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren. And please welcome, or please join me in welcoming our speaker, Jordan from Encinitas.
I only got 5 minutes. Great. Good evening. My name is Jordan. I'm an alcoholic. I'll start here. I would thank the our secretary Marcia for asking us to speak. But truth be told, I actually I was a secretary last term, and I put my name on this term to be able to speak. So that settles that. I got sober in March of 2009. My sobriety date is March 25th, 2009. And I'll tell you why my sobriety date is March 25th, 2009. The bracelet on the that I got while I was in the hospital at Gardena Memorial said March 25th, 2009. So that's my sobriety date. Dating back, what it was like and what happened, what happened now. From what I can remember, the beginning was, like any other, what was the beginning like? Maybe I should say the Serenity Prayer. A couple of days ago I was supposed to do, an outline. My parents are here in the front row and they recommended I do an outline. And, I'll be honest, I'm coming up on 3 years of sobriety, but there's a lot of cleansing that I still have to do. And, if you're new here in the rooms, or maybe you've been here a while in the rooms and you feel like there's cleansing that you have to do, the steps and, that's what I believe is natural. You hear a lot of these, people say, the people that get here and, everything just happens to work out for them, like that's not real. That could be real. Like maybe you get here and, your sobriety, everything just clicks like that. All your emotional baggage, all the records of your past cleans up, but mine doesn't. I still have the, the wounds that, I created for myself and that I created upon other people's lives. And, that's alcoholism. That's drug addiction. And, I'm in acceptance of that today. And, I'm in acceptance of that partly because I sat here with the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous and they told me one day at a time, everything was going to be all right. And, I believe that today. I sit in the back every single meeting I go to. We joke around and call the back half measures row. And, half measures row has so far worked for me. Every Monday and Friday when I can, I try to go to, Denny's or Carol or a local diner because that was told that I do. I was told, like other members shared here this evening during their birthday share, to, get involved with a group of people, stick close, find the winners, find the losers, find whomever is staying sober one day at a time. And that's what I've done. I've also hung out with knuckleheads in sobriety. I've racked up a lot of tickets. I've caused problems with law enforcement. I've caused problems at home. I've caused problems in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've caused problems within my own life. But I'm human. And I also learned that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not justifying, I'm not rationalizing anything of that. That's just my story. I am who I am. And, when I came here, I was ashamed who I am. And, to be honest, the only reason I'm not ashamed who I am today is because, once again, these people in Alcoholics Anonymous shared their experience, their hope with me. And they made me realize that I'm not that unique, special individual that my alcoholism likes to tell me that I am. And I found out the reason my alcoholism and drug addiction tells me that, so those isms can put me in a place where I believe one more time that getting drunk and getting high is the only option. You know, I was joking with my buddy Richard in the back. He said the door is all jammed up back there, and he told me that he couldn't get in. And he jokingly said, you know, Jordan, I told you there were some junkies back in there because I figured you'd go back there and, you know, knock the door down. And I did. And don't get me wrong, if I could use drugs and alcohol today, I would. You know, I do not like to feel what reality feels like at this point in my life. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that there are ways, there are actions, there are suggestions that I don't always take, and there are solutions here that can make me more comfortable in this reality that my brain tells me that I'm not fit for. My mind tells me that I'm not able to handle. My mind tells me that, you know, you're just not cut out. And that's okay. Because there's millions of other people that have felt that same way. You know, I've heard countless stories in the rooms, outside of the rooms, and hell, I don't know. So, you know, when I was 12 years old, the first time I remember having a drink, and my folks and I, we were at an event in Poway, and believe it or not, both the individuals that I had a drink now today, one of them is actually sober, I believe, 5 years, and he's actually the resident manager of a sober living in Torrance, California. Now, the other one, I believe, is still in his first year of sobriety, but he has also chosen the path that everyone in this, well, at least speaking for myself, what I've chosen tonight, and what I believe you guys have all chosen tonight, and that's the path of sobriety. And, you know, there was no reason I chose to drink and use drugs. I mean, at that time, at that place when I was 12 years old, what I remember is I was hanging with these kids. They're about a couple years older than me, and they just said, let's have a couple drinks. I said, all right. So I had a beer and that was it. I thought nothing of it. And that was that. You know, seventh grade rolls around. Middle school, you know, I'm guessing puberty happened. And it still is. And you know, once again, those you know, feelings that I just described earlier took hold. You know, I wasn't fit. I had to do this. I had to do that. And I had to do that. So actually, on my natal birthday, which is February 1st, I decided to you know, drink and smoke some marijuana behind a local movie theater. And I mean, that was that. That's what I did. You know, I didn't think really much of it. You know, I went forward with my life, and that was that. You know, I drank and I smoked, and nothing happened. You know, but as I got older, that wasn't always the same. You know, my father, you know, when I was growing up, he told me that, you know, that I was a good baseball player. And so what I did is I pursued my baseball career, and, you know, he coached me for like 10 years or something like that. You know, and that's what I did. You know, I played baseball. You know, I played at some of the finest parks growing up within San Diego County. And that was all great. But, you know, drugs and alcohol just changed all that. You know, when I began experiencing those that euphoria, those highs that drugs and alcohol make us all feel like, nothing really could top that. Nothing really could top that. And still to this day, you know, I get chills, you know, because there really is nothing that can top the experience that the way that drugs and alcohol make me feel. And there probably never will be. But, you know, by sitting in these rooms one day at a time, I believe I've opened, you know, I've become open to different alternatives, different ways in reality to experiencing joy. And, you know, so, yeah. Let's see. By the way, happy birthday to our birthday people. I know I'm skipping around here a little bit. You know, I'm like the book says, selfish and self-centered to the core. So, you know, the fact that I'm even mentioning these people is something. it's progress. you know, I'll be honest, I don't really remember any much of my adolescenthood, so I'm going to skip to really what I remember. And those are really, you know, I was arrested at 14 years old for possession of marijuana on campus. And that was actually the one day I decided not to get high. My teacher thought I was under the influence when in fact I wasn't. Now, maybe I need medication, maybe I don't, but whatever, you know. I was arrested also at 13 again. I developed a habit for stealing from what wasn't mine. Another good trait, you know. And that habit actually followed me a lot of years. Stealing what's not mine. But so, you know, that's what happened. As a result of you know, those two arrests right there, the middle school didn't believe that I was fit to be involved in that school. And by all means, like, they were right. You know, but did that change? No. You know, I was put into an alcohol and drug outpatient program and put on a diversion program. And it made me go to some counseling meetings. And all I did was lie. And by that time, I had ruined everything else that was going on in my life. So I was proud of my drinking and drugging. That was all I had to talk about. You know, every time we go hang out, it was, hey, can you get this? Hey, can you get that? I drank this. Hey, I drank that. Blah, 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 blah. That's all I really could talk about. I was completely had the obsession of the mind of drugs and alcohol by the time I was 14 years old. And so I went to another school where I was exposed to, I think I was 14 by then, crystal meth and cocaine. So for anybody that thinks they started young, you know, I started young too. And it doesn't make any difference. You know, I ended up here and I think that's it, you know. And so I went there and I did the same thing. I took that same reputation I had at middle school into this new middle school because I was like the book says, I was afraid of change even at that young 14-year-old age. And instead of going to this new school and capitalizing on the opportunity to start over, what did I do? I shaved my head. I started wearing Doc Martin boots and pronouncing that I was a Nazi skinhead at 14 years old. I couldn't tell you why today. You know, I really couldn't. I can tell you guys all events, but I really, my recollection is very scattered. And that's okay. So I started dressing like a Nazi skinhead and as I was 14 years old, and I was even brazen enough to actually go to a drug group where we went to Donovan State Prison with my head freshly shaved at 14 years old. Just I couldn't tell you what I was thinking. I just wasn't thinking. So, long story short, I managed to go through that middle school and I was now back in the mainstream of high school. At this time, I continued playing baseball with all the kids I grew up with. A couple of them are here today. My real close friends that I grew up with, they chose to do the same thing that I did. That was deal drugs, steal from people, and just be a downright loser. And I'm sorry to say that about them. I don't mean that about them as it comes out of my mouth. That's just who I was. Those were the type of people that I ran with because that's all I knew. Or that's all I chose to do, actually. I knew better. My parents definitely raised me better than that. But speaking from this alcoholic, when I ingest drugs and alcohol, this just I don't even know what happens. Shit just happens. And so I moved on to this this high school now, and I'm back in with everybody. Instead of once again taking this new opportunity to start a new, develop my career as a baseball player and, you know, get the good grades that I'm achievable of, what do I decide to do? I decide to do what I know how to do, and that's sell drugs, find anything and everything, illegal contraband. That's just what I knew how to do. You know, that was my way of getting respect from you, was just black market bullshit at a young age. That's instead of, you know, capitalizing on the positive things that I had, that's what I did. And so I did that. I was arrested again for another under the influence at school and in possession at school. And they put me in another rehabilitation program. The place was called Phoenix House. And those are the best couple years of my life. And, I was with a girlfriend of mine for about 2 years during that time. My whole life clicked. Everything made sense for those 2 years. You know, at least on a five-panel drug test, that is. For those of you that don't know, Special K, known as ketamine and magic mushrooms, do not show up on drug tests. So, hell, I was head of the recovery house, and I was loaded. That's what I knew how to do. Lie, cheat, steal, and once again, find a way to use drugs and alcohol and cheat the system. So I dropped out of high school at about 17 years old, and by that time, the school didn't arrest me anymore. I was under the influence of a lot of narcotics and sedatives and alcohol at the time. My teachers just kind of let me go. They wouldn't report me to the principals. I'd sleep every single class. I'd drool. And, if they sent me to the office, the police would just tell me to go home. I couldn't really tell you why today. The first thought that comes to my head was I used to sell drugs for this family, and unfortunately these kids' parents, she was one of us, a daily drinker. She was always under the influence of alcohol, and she passed away, and this is she passed away in front of me of a alcohol overdose. And instead of calling the police, I had him call the police, where I proceeded to I went upstairs and, I actually, pocketed all the rest of the drugs in the house. And that's where my drugs and alcohol told me that instead of saving this woman's life, that it'd be okay to just go get the rest of the drugs in the house. And while she died. And I think that was really why they didn't bother arresting me anymore. So I dropped out of school at this time from alcohol abuse and heavy cocaine abuse. I developed hallucinations, and I wasn't really able to attend school anymore. And I'd quit baseball at this time. I'd really quit everything at the time. I started getting a bunch of tattoos at the age of 17, and I'm actually in the process of getting those removed. That's another gift of sobriety, where I'm going to get to in a minute. And by the time I was 17 to 22 was really the bottom. Like I said, I basically allowed this woman to die, and my best friend he passed away from drugs and alcohol the following year. That was really about it. I woke up every single day to drink. I woke up every single day to get high, only because every time I had a feeling, that was the best answer. That was the best answer that I can come up with. I developed so much shame, so much resentment, so much embarrassment to who I was. About the time of 18 years old, the best thought that came to my mind was using alcohol, sedatives, and and cocaine daily. And that was the only time I actually felt like I could dream, you know. You know, today it's different. You know, today I wake up, you know, I'm an ASC certified mechanic. You know, today I wake up and, you know, I have dreams of, you know, going farther in the field. You know, I have dreams of, you know, making a living, you know, purchasing my own home, you know, paying the bills, becoming a, you know, a law-abiding citizen. But, you know, back when I was 17, I was 18 years old, the only way that was possible for me to even think some positive thought like that was to ingest drugs and alcohol. And, that's just my story. So, you know, like I going back by the time, you know, I was 18 years old, that's where I was at. By the time I was 19 years old, I was indicted for drug trafficking in Mexico. I thought it would be okay to try to smuggle drugs across the border. And, I was so incoherent and lost on drugs and alcohol that I was actually picked up, by an undercover because I was wandering around Mexico looking for my car. I couldn't find a damn car. Couldn't find a fucking car. I spent 72 hours down there and, literally by the grace of God, my parents, got wind that I was down in Mexico from a girl that I was dating at the time. And they got a lawyer who basically traded my life for a suitcase of cash. And I'm fortunate in that respect. You know, and now, you know, in these times, you know, that really doesn't happen. You know, but you know, long story short, that didn't stop me. The next week, I was picked up. You know, some drugs and alcohol, and, you know, my friend got a DUI where the cops let me go, because once again, I was just too incoherent to even be arrested. You know, they didn't even know what to do with me. They just sent me home. And, you know, that's where I was introduced to my first, recovery house was after that briefing. I was in, I think, April of 2008. They went up to a place called, New Life in Torrance, California, where they showed me that through severe discipline and, you know, a rigid program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that there was a possibility that I didn't have to drink and I didn't have to use. And after going there for about 8 months, I decided that, you know, I didn't belong there. You know, they wanted to keep me on, you know, medication and blah, 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 blah. And I thought I should have a job. So I moved to a sober living. And at the sober living, I did good for about 3 months. And, you know, but I got impatient with the process of recovery. And I got ungrateful for the 8 months of recovery that I did have. And I got pissed off that at 20 years old, here I was, you know, biking 3 miles to Fry's Electronics in Manhattan Beach while everyone else had a goddamn BMW and they were off at university. And what I failed to realize was every kid that my age that was doing those type of things had earned those type of things. You know, they'd gotten the grades in high school. They'd taken the actions. They'd taken the steps they'd had to do to go to those places. And what had I done? I'd committed crimes, dropped out of school, created hell for my parents and anyone that I came into contact with, and was basically, you know, I was nothing more than an alcoholic in the disease, a drug addict in the disease. And so I decided to start using with my roommate at the time. And on early March, probably, I'm just guessing the 23rd, because I said my sobriety day is the 25th. I thought it would be cool to mix alcohol. This is 22nd. Let's skip to like early March. So like early March... Early March, I had decided that, you know, drinking Jack Daniels, quitting my job, and playing Call of Duty 4 on the PlayStation would be, like, the dream. And that was the dream, actually, because when I ingested alcohol, everything was all good again. Everything went away. You know, I saw life exactly how life was. You know, I got along with people. You know, life made sense again. Except the problem was now that I had 8 months of Alcoholics Anonymous within me. So the second that high wore off and the second that buzz wore off, I experienced what I could never experience before, or I was never conscious enough to experience before, and that was the obsession. And the last month of my drinking and using up there at Lawndale, all I remember was I only drank and I only used heroin and Xanax and Valium and cocaine because I wanted to get that damn thought to go away in my head. And that thought just kept telling me to get high, get high, get high, get drunk, get drunk, get drunk. So I wasn't, in the end, I wasn't getting high. I just wanted that damn thought to go away. And when I did get high, the thought did go away. But then the high would wear off. And that thought became more thoughts. And then all the problems I had before, they mushroomed again. And once again, I was back at stage one. So I think on the 23rd, I decided that it would be necessary to ingest Valium, Xanax, ecstasy, and heroin, because that's what I used to do. That's what Jordan remembers doing. And long story short, I ended up in I remember waking up in Gardena Memorial on a hospital bed. I couldn't breathe, and I was dying, apparently. Sober, the house manager found me apparently dead, and they had to go get me all jump-started again, and I guess I had a congestive heart failure, respiratory failure, and just general failure, you know? Oh, and this is where it starts to get good, I promise. I remember sitting on I grabbed one of the nurses and I said, "Hey, dude, am I going to die?" But not like that. And I said, "Look, man, am I going to die?" Because I felt like I was going to die. You know, I was dying. And, you know, none of them answered me. And I remember the looks on their face was like the most horrid thing I've ever seen. And they told me that my kidneys were failing and that I was dying, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember, you know, I put my head back and for the first time I told God, I said, "God, look, if this is where I'm at, I'm ready to go, man. God knows I've been trying to kill myself for the last decade." And I said, "But if not, you know, that's it." And for the first time in my drug and alcohol life, I came into a complete acceptance of where I was at. The exact magnitude of where I was at. I was dying from probably respiratory failure at this time because they got my heart going. So it's probably, you know, I still want to get those reports, you know. I think it'd be necessary, you know, just to combat that alcoholism, you know. Get those reports from Gardena. And so I remember when I said that to God or the higher power is, you know, what happened next. I remember I felt this peace. For the first time in my life, I felt peace. Here I was dying on a hospital table, and for the first time in my life, I felt absolute peace. And I knew when I woke up, a couple of days later, I knew when I woke up that if I can experience that kind of peace and that kind of turmoil, that there was going to be hope for me. Because what God revealed to me when I was dying on a hospital bed, He revealed to me that for the first time, or actually first time I got through my denial, that drugs and alcohol were my problem. Now, I'm sorry I'm that hard-headed, but I'm that hard-headed that it took me to actually die to realize that drugs and alcohol were my problem. So I spent the next couple weeks recovering at Gardena Memorial. I couldn't really move. They said I had a bunch of muscle damage and all sorts of garbage going on. And I remember, you know, I just said, "Hell, this is it." I convinced my parents to allow me to come back home. I said, you know, sober living is not the place for me. I'm clearly just out of my mind. And they created literally like a 15-page manifesto of all these rules, all these stipulations, all this shit that I had to follow. I kid you not, Sean and Elena Cassidy right there developed their own in-house sober living for an alcoholic and a drug addict that usually ends up in a grave. And I went there, and for the first few months, what I did, they told me I wasn't allowed to leave the house for the first year. For the first few months, I was on a regimented schedule. I got up, I made my bed every day, I read a bunch of spiritual crap, you know. And, you know, I did what I was told. I dug holes in the yard, and, you know, at about 3 months sober, I think my mom started driving me up here to San Clemente, and that's where, you know, I'd say I'm from Encinitas. You know, my mom thought it'd be a good start if she drove me up from San Clemente, and that's where I ended here on a Monday night. I was actually looking for the Narcotics Anonymous meeting that I point people to now on Monday nights here, and you know, I stuck in the rooms, and believe it or not, my mom came to me with a meeting. Came with me to meetings for the first few months of my sobriety, sat with me in the rooms, and then we drive home. And that's my story. My mom sat here with me in the meetings, and I was just that done. I didn't even care anymore. It's like, I'm so burned out. You know, Mom, if you want to sit here in the meetings with me, by all means, I can't even put a sentence together. And, you know, I hooked up with the members of these rooms. And, you know, I got a commitment here on Monday night, you know, as a literature. And, you know, I spoke, you know, I began to share, you know, I got a sponsor. My first sponsor took me through the steps, where my first four step was all about what everyone else did to myself. Took me about 3-4 steps to realize that no one really did anything to me. Everything I did was because I am a drug addict and an alcoholic, and when I put drugs and alcohol in my body, those are the actions that I do. And, you know, that was that. You know, I went through the steps. You know, I started going to school. My parents let me go to school here early, you know, because I said they're going to keep me locked up for a year. And they said, hell, you go to school. So actually, I drove up all the way to Saddleback College to go to school because I still, you know, wasn't allowed really to, you know, I just wasn't good in my own hometown. And so I just kept doing the deal. I kept going to meetings. Every time I had a feeling, I'd go to a meeting. Every time I had a thought, I'd call somebody. I must have called, I don't even know how many people in the first year of sobriety. I mean, I remember like a class, I'd call somebody before class, call someone after, like, the teacher took roll at class. I'd call somebody during break at class and after class, and I'd go to a meeting, call someone after the meeting, and I really just kept, you know, doing what the rooms, you know, told me, you know, pick up the phone, you know, work the steps, go to meetings, and, you know, and share. And so I kept doing that, and, you know, I began to develop actual friendships here, actual relationships here, and, you know, I began starting to become recognized for something that was actually good for the first time in my life, you know, since drinking and using, and that was, you know, being sober and trying to do something here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that felt good. And, you know, I took my first year, and then I was depressed from year one to year two. You know, I was all about getting to that first year. When I got to that first year, like, what do I do now? So that sucked. But, you know, I kept doing what they told me to do, and I was, you know, call people, you know, read literature, share in meetings, work with a sponsor, and do that. And then about a year sober, you know, I got, my parents told me I'd get a car when I got year sober, so I got a Honda Civic, and everything's been downhill since then. I've put the same effort that I've put into my sobriety and my you know, my automotive career, and you know, at times it's actually you know, probably looked like untreated alcoholism, but you know, it's been a blessing in disguise. So you know, today I'm a you know I work 40 hours a week at, you know, Pep Boys in Encinitas. You know, I start school here on the 23rd at MiraCosta College in Oceanside, just to further my, you know, studies here in the automotive field. And, you know, like I said before, you know, I still do everything that I did when I got here. And for anybody that's new, you know, all I really recommend is that you don't drink and you don't use. You know, because what I found by not drinking and not using, that eventually I've gotten a place where some of the other suggestions felt right that the other members told me. So that's really it. I know I shared a real good drunkalog. I really didn't mean to do that. You know, it's I really wanted to share about the gifts of recovery, but you know, let me just leave you with this. At 20 years old, I'll be 23 in February. At 20 years old, I remember being at that sober living in Torrance, and I remember I told myself that if I could get a full time job as a dishwasher, like that would be the dream. Like I'd be it. I've made it. And nothing wrong with your dishwasher, but you know, alcoholics, you know, my drug addiction and alcoholism had destroyed me so much, where people are thinking of these big dreams of what they're going to do with their life and how they're going to make a difference in the world. That at 20 years old, I was begging for mercy from God that he would allow me to just hold a job as a dishwasher. And today I'm really blessed because there's people in these rooms that continue to sit with me every single day. And so that's happy birthday once again. You know, got to get my selflessness out right now. And yeah. That's it. Thanks.